here's an opportunity for you to join the KBOO board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application, or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is July 13, 2019. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community, and who want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Stop the Hate, Saturday, June 29th at noon at Chapman Square in Portland. On Saturday, June 29th, the Proud Boys Hate Group is planning to gather in downtown Portland, looking for targets for violent attacks. This can mean assaulting random pedestrians, looking for progressive activists to attack, or targeting community events. Those against white supremacy and fascists will gather to defend our community against this racist political violence. Again, that's Stop the Hate, Saturday, June 29th at noon at Chapman Square, 210 Southwest Main in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Heather McCoy Show.
And welcome to the Heather McCoy Show. Later on in the hour, I'll be replaying an interview I did in 2015 with Dawn Pele. She's the author of Drug War Capitalism. I think it's a really relevant interview to be playing in the wake of our current border crisis. And first, we're joined from France, LA Times beat writer for the U.S. National Women's Team for the LA Times. Kevin Baxter's joining us. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thank you very much. You know, there's a lot of Portland connections to tomorrow's game between France and the U.S. A lot of former thorns on both sides.
Yeah, there's Henri. That's the only French player I know off the top of my head that has been a thorn. Of course, then there's Horan, Sonnet, Tobin Heath. There's a lot of thorns on the American sides, but am I missing another French player?
Well, Henri, the role that she fills for that team is kind of really both. Two players. She's a big part of that team, but as Tobin Heath said yesterday, once a thorn, always a thorn. So it'll be interesting to see how those players go up against each other, because they have tremendous respect for each other. They were former teammates, a lot of them, and you know, as Tobin said, once a thorn, always a thorn. So there's that respect there, and there are a lot of Portland fans here as well. I've seen them on the trains and buses around Paris. We've heard them at the games. So again, Portland well represented both in the stands and on the field tomorrow.
Yeah, that is one question. I never made it past high school in my soccer career. That was the end of it. It would be weird to have a teammate that I know so well, and now I'm pairing up against her. I've never had that experience before. Has Tobin and the other Thorns commented on that?
Well, they talked about it early in the tournament, not specifically those players, but having matched up against other players. They didn't play Canada, but of course Christine Sinclair is here, and players have run into, Lindsay Horan has played here at PSG, Tobin Heath played here,
yeah.
Alex Morgan and Megan Rapinoe played in Lyon, so a lot of these players have run into each other in international games before, and it's not as strange as you might think. It probably was the first one or two times, and you probably wanted to show your teammate up a little bit, but it's gotten to the point now at this level, these players have faced each other so many times. you know, going against former teammates. That I actually talked to Christine Sinclair about this a couple months ago, and she said, you know, it's just so normal now that you really don't think about it anymore.
Yeah. Canada exited out of the tournament. They were defeated by Sweden. Is there a sense of shock about that? Or is Sweden, they don't have a lot of offensive firepower as far as forwards go. They don't have a Schelin or a Hanna Lundberg. They just have a couple of players up front. Was that a shock in France that the Swedes did beat Canada?
You know, I think I would say shock, but I think surprised that Norway and Sweden made it this far. You know, Norway is going to be playing in the England, I believe, tonight. Some surprise that those teams are still around because they don't look impressive on paper, but you play them on the field and they're very tough to beat. And you look at Sweden, yeah, they don't have a lot of offensive firepower, but remember back in the Olympics in the quarterfinals, they beat the U.S. by going to penalty kicks, by playing defensively. So what they do is they don't look great. They don't. It's not super entertaining. It's not probably a game you're going to want to watch at 2 in the morning when you're bored, but they win.
And, yeah.
You know, they win, and that's the important thing. And in this kind of a tournament, that's all that matters at this point. You know, there are a lot of teams, especially on the men's side, that want to play attractive football, and they really care about that. In the World Cup, it's just winning, and however you do that, it's just fine.
Yeah, I've been really impressed with Aslani from the Swedish side. She's an amazing midfielder. And then Lundell, she's been goalkeeping since 2003, and it's her last go-around. And people may not know this, but I'm actually a Swedish fan first, a U.S. fan second. And so it's kind of a bittersweet journey seeing her last times in goal.
The thing with Sweden is it was unfortunate that we didn't get to see the best Swedish team against America, against the USA in the group stage. Both teams had already gone through. There was a lot of talk about whether Jill Ellis would rest some of her regulars in the hope of avoiding France in the quarterfinals, which is the game, of course, we're waiting for in about 26 hours from now. Sweden was the one that actually did that. Sweden rested 7 starters and basically conceded the group to the United States. It's worked out well for Sweden. They did very well, you know, getting out of the group and continuing on. And then U.S. now has France, and they said that's just fine. Look, if you're going to win the tournament, you have to beat everybody at some point anyways, all the good teams. But we didn't get to see Sweden go against the U.S., and there was a little bit of revenge for the U.S., wanting to avenge that 2016 game in Rio. And as you said, just two really good teams. Let's put it on the field and see what happens. You know, the other surprise that you haven't mentioned is there were 9 European teams here. 5 of them won their group. 8 of them advanced to the round of 16. The U.S. is now the only non-European team left in the quarterfinals, in the final 8, 7 European teams. That's never happened in a men or women's World Cup before.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that. Like in your article about the Spanish football, you state that Dutch star Elike Martins, a former World Player of the Year, is playing club soccer for Spain for a contract she signed in 2017 for $200,000 a year. That's roughly what Marta makes with the Orlando Pride here in the U.S. domestic league in the NWSL. There are reports that Sam Kerr has a contract offer in the millions of dollars for the European League. What are the chances that the European clubs raid the NWSL and leave it a lot like the MLS?
That's so funny that you mentioned that, because that has been an actual huge topic of conversation there, because we're seeing teams like, you know, Barcelona now has a lot of money. They really started investing in their women's program in 2015. And let's not get too excited. What they're paying Leike Martins and what they're investing in their team is pocket change for what they give to Messi and some of the other players there. So let's not go overboard and say that they've gone, you know, whole hog. But they are investing. Real Madrid, the richest club in the world, is now starting a women's team. We've seen what Manchester City has done, building the training complex and things and the stadium for the women. So the European teams are getting involved. You know, in NWSL, I know the national team players, their salaries are paid by the U.S. Soccer Foundation, but the maximum wage in the NWSL is $46,000 a year. You know, some of these European teams will begin raiding the U.S. It only makes sense. The U.S. is the number one ranked team in the world, and they have been for years. You know, there's 23 players on that national team roster that are just ripe to be offered some big contracts, and some of them have come over here and play. We talked about Megan Rapinoe and Tobin Heath and Lindsey Horan. I do think after this World Cup, you're going to see a lot of these European teams. they're looking at women's soccer. They're seeing the TV ratings in Brazil and Sweden and England and Spain and, you know, in France. The highest audience for a women's game before this World Cup was about 4.6 million. The Spanish team, the French team is averaging over 10 million in this World Cup. So there are people interested in these games. They're consumers. They'll follow these teams. In France now, the national network in France now has a contract to show one women's game on national TV every week.
Oh, that's cool.
So yeah, I do think the money is there. The interest, I think that was the one thing holding everybody back a little bit, the interest. I think this World Cup has proven there is an interest in European and European countries for women's football. And when you see how well these national teams are doing, I do think it's going to spark an interest, and I think NWSL is going to have to step up its game.
Yeah, and that's the other thing about it. It's not just the money. Jackie Becky from Canada and Ella Masser, the United States, Ella Masser's only got one national team cap, but she was part of the Houston Dash. I think Becky was too, and then their careers were kind of going south, and they reinvented themselves in Europe. So it's not just about the pay. It's also actually about coaching and player development too.
Well, and you've seen a lot of players that have come here. You know, the goalkeeper from Chile went and played in Spain for a while, was the Spanish goalkeeper of the year. 1 year gave up 9 goals, you know, her entire season in Spain, then came to PSG, was the goalkeeper of the year in France. Those are opportunities she does not get in South America, especially in Chile. So she comes over here and becomes one of the best players in the world. That's the kind of stuff that maybe the U.S. doesn't necessarily need. I don't know that NWSL necessarily is on the par with the French League and some of the European leagues. But U.S. players certainly get that competition when they go to national team camps and they play 25, 28 games a year with the national team. So that's fine. But the younger players and then the foreign players coming over here, I think what you may see is it winds up strengthening the U.S. over time, because there's only room for so many players on the U.S. national team. There's only room for so many of those subsidized salaries in NWSL. If you have maybe 35th best player in the U.S. goes over and plays at Lyon or PSG, you know, could fit right into a team there, get really good, and come back and be a factor for the U.S. national team. So it may hurt NWSL in the short term, but I think it helps the national team in the long term.
Well, it also helps players that are kind of on the, like, the journeywomen players. One of my favorite NWSL players was Maddie Evans from the Orlando Pride, and she retired mid-season so she can coach a Division II team because that paid more.
Yeah, and you see that a lot. One of my favorite players is Megan Klingenberg, and she for whatever reason kind of wore out her welcome with the U.S. national team, didn't fit anymore, but she's a great player. What if she had gone to Europe and maybe taken her game to another level and came back and been a factor? We saw how she played in the last World Cup.
Yeah,
she's still playing. I mean, she's a very good player. The other thing I think we'll see is perhaps NWSL, which is not a bad thing, and remember, all we're talking about right now is speculation. This is just things may happen. But you look at MLS, and it's become a place for a lot of South American, Central American players, Caribbean players to come. You know, there's a lot of Hondurans, Salvadorans, and Uruguayans now. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, the Brazilians and the Argentinians and the big players, they go to Europe, and you know, MLS has some great players. What if NWSL becomes that kind of a league? That, you know, many players from the Jamaican team, which was in this World Cup, play in NWSL and have played in NWSL. I don't think it's necessarily a death knell for the league. I think they just have to sort of recreate themselves a little bit. But I think in the long term, it's great for women's soccer. The money is certainly there. It's not here in the United States. So, why not go play at Lyon for a few years? Why not go play at Manchester City as Carly Lloyd did, if that's going to help your career? And certainly if that's going to make it so that you can support your family. That's one of the things that the people at Barcelona told me is, look, we want to help the players, give them a place to train. We want to support them, support staff with the medical staff. We want to give them everything the men have. But on top of that, we need to pay them enough so they don't have to go to another job, because that just messes everything all up. They've got to concentrate 100% on football, and we need to pay them a living wage to do that.
Yeah, and I would be remiss to say this, but I have heard very substantiated reports from a friend of mine that was covering the Houston Dash, that he hears rumors that 3 NWSL clubs will close if a World Cup, if there's not a World Cup attendance bounce for the domestic league.
Yeah, we were talking about that too here, looking at the attendance figures. And, you know, there was a lot of crowds under 2,000 this last weekend, or the last round of games. And yeah, I know a lot of the players are gone, but I mean, you know, Orlando does okay, not great. North Carolina does okay, not great. Chicago is not caught on yet, as we know. The team in New Jersey is not caught on yet. The Thorns, you know, growing great guns, but they're really the only one, and you can't expect one team to support the rest of the league. You do kind of wonder, what else can the NWSL do? They already have some of the best players in the world. They have some of the biggest name players in the world because they're national team players, like Alex Morgan playing you know, in Orlando, and Carly Lloyd playing back on the East Coast. If people won't come out to see them, what can we do to draw them out? And it might be the World Cup bounce that saves the league, or again, you know, do they have to reinvent themselves? Let's not forget the Women's Soccer League went bankrupt twice. This yeah. league seems to be a lot better organized, but it's still looking for its financial footing as well.
Yeah. On Monday, the U.S. Women's National Team beat Spain in the round of 16 with a score 2-1. The U.S. scored two penalty kicks while Jennifer Hermosa scored Spain's only goal in the run of play. What were the main takeaways for the United States coming out of that game and the quarterfinals matchup coming up with France?
Well, they wouldn't admit it, but I had to wonder a little bit whether they were looking past Spain just a bit because they knew that game with France was looming. And that's all anyone has really talked about since we got here. I think it was sort of assumed that the U.S. would get out of group play. They've always gotten out of group play. I don't know that anyone thought that they would play as well as they did. This was the first time the U.S. has had three consecutive clean sheets in group play. So I wonder if they were a little bit, I don't want to say cocky, but a little bit confident and looked past Spain just a little bit. That's on the U.S. side. On the Spanish side, Spain was great. They just came out and they said, we don't care who we're playing. We're going to go after them. They were very physical. They really beat up Alex Morgan. They really focused their defensive game plan on her. Spain played a great game. And I think the future is looking really great for Spain. Not only in their second World Cup did they get out of the group stage, but last year they won the U15 or U17 World Cup, and they finished second in the U20 World Cup. They made the final. So a lot of good young players coming up, and then the investment we talked about, Barcelona, Real Madrid. You know, they had that game in Madrid last year with 60,000 plus people there. So I think the takeaway for me from that game was Spain's really good. And the women's game is getting really good. It used to be, as I was talking to JP Della Camera, who's doing the games on Fox, and he said, he remembers a day when the U.S. could show up and roll the ball out and win. Those days are long gone.
Yeah, those are long gone. Hermosa's goal did come on a bad ball handling decision from the goalie, Alyssa Nair, to Becky Sauerbrunn. Yeah. Is there any confidence shaken in Nair and the back line in general?
No, they've all talked about that. And I think a good sign for U.S. fans was that both Nair and Becky Sauerbrunn argued with one another about who was responsible for that error. So the idea is they're together, they're collective, there's no finger pointing. They're all stepping up and taking responsibility. They both realized they made a mistake. And as one of the U.S. players said, that's one mistake you're never going to see again. You can cross that off the list because, you know, they've both taken responsibility for that. Jill Ellis talked a little bit about that today and said that Alyssa Nauer is still super confident. That was a question going in, though. I think anytime you replace someone like a Hope Solo, no matter who is stepping in, there's that question, are they that good? You know, that goal that Alyssa Nauer gave up, and as you said, it was on a mistake, that's the first one she's given up since April. And they've played some good teams. They played a lot of World Cup teams since then. So I think one goal in, 4 months, the U.S. can probably live with that.
Yeah, definitely. Let's talk about VAR. It's been, throughout the entire match, it's been a thing. And it's... And it's been used through the first 44 games 29 times, four more reviews than the entire 64 games that make up the Men's World Cup. VAR has screwed over Scotland twice, Nigeria and Cameroon. In the Cameroon match, England was leading 2-0 when a bad pass turned into a goal, but was later called offsides as video replay. My main issue with the call is that, while it was technically correct that the Cameroon player was offsides, it was by such a fraction it wouldn't have ever been picked up by the human eye at all. It could only be seen in by broadcast quality cameras, with essentially. These margins always exist in the game, and they're part of the flow. What is the feeling in response to use of VAR in France?
Well, I asked that very same question yesterday because every, many players are being reviewed. The second penalty kick in the U.S. game, the Rose Lavelle penalty, the referee took 4 minutes to review that and looked at 12 different camera angles. Again, this is something that until last year, this referee would have been making that decision with the naked eye. Now she has 4 minutes and 12 camera angles to look at. I'm with you. I mean, and there was a FIFA referees committee press conference yesterday, and they talked about how nobody's perfect and no team is perfect and teams make mistakes. But then they turn around and said, we're going to use video replay because we don't want our referees to make any mistake. And I understand that, but there's a human element to the game. And when there are, and they talked about, look, there is no such thing as a barely offside and way offside. It's offside. If you're 2 centimeters offside or you're 20 yards offside, you're offside. And I'm kind of with you. If you can't see the 2 centimeters with the naked eye, it's part of the game. And they actually broke down. If you remember, Japan was eliminated because there was a handball called against Japan in the box late in the game, led to a penalty kick. The Netherlands converted, and they went on. And so the handball was reviewed, and you can make an argument that the Japanese player, it was unintentional, but it was a handball. But my point is they went back to the buildup. When they look at some of these plays, they actually go back to the buildup to make sure that there wasn't anything happening in the buildup that could negate the goal. There was a feeling that the ball was offside, that the ball had gone beyond the sideline and was out of play in the lead-up to that. The referees committee showed us several photos. All of the photos showed the ball was out of play. Then they produced one photo that showed the ball was in play, was on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, I don't know. The naked eye doesn't catch that. Several photos had the ball being out of line. Then they find one, and they said, okay, this is the one that proves that the play should continue and that the goal was good. Players make errors. Managers, coaches make errors. I think a referee making an error, I understand sometimes it's going to be a big error, but correct the obvious ones. That's what instant replay was all about. If football's had instant replay. I was there when baseball sort of invented their decision to go to instant replay. There was a ball hit into the stands. A guy with a white shirt stood up. The ball hit the fan. The white shirt fell to the ground. The umpire couldn't see that. TV replay showed it. The idea was everyone in the world knew that was a home run, except the umpire who had to make the call, and that was wrong, and we need to correct that. But I don't think anyone ever had the intention of, let's take a look at 16 camera angles, and at 15 show one thing and one show something else, then we'll overturn the call. And the other thing is some of the coaches here, Tom Sermani of New Zealand was one who said, the delays are just too long. We have players standing around. We have spectators wanting the game to go on. And finally, lastly, I'm going on way too long on this, but
no,
lastly,
you're fine.
One of the things that bothered me about it is, and I asked the FIFA referee committee about it yesterday, it seems that the referees are looking over their shoulder. Any critical call, they stop and they want VAR. And the referees are not calling the game confidently like they had before. They insist that that was not correct and that they told the referees to call the games the same way, but it's simply not happening. You see a close play, and the referee blows the whistle and immediately puts her hand to her ear because she wants to hear what the video replay official is saying. That's not the way the game should be managed.
I turned against VAR during the Men's World Cup. One of my professors is from Iran, and so since the U.S. didn't qualify, I was cheering on the Iranian team. It was like a really insignificant play, and it didn't even have a card, and it turned into like a NFL replay, Segruder film, fast forward, go back, fast forward, go back, and that's not the way soccer's supposed to be played.
No, it's a game. Remember, it's a game with a running clock for a reason. That's part of the game. And now all of a sudden when you say, well, there's a running clock, but we're all going to stand around for 4 minutes while someone watches TV, that damages the game. There's certain things that it damages, like the fact that players are supposed to have stamina to run for 90 minutes. If they're standing around for 4 minutes, the team on the offensive all of a sudden loses that momentum. The team that's defending, that's trying to see out the game, they gain. There's just a lot of perhaps unseen things. And I understand that they want to get all the calls right. They bragged yesterday about how they've gotten more than 98% of the calls in this World Cup correct. You know, that's great, but the players haven't made 98% of their plays correctly. Again, I kind of like the fact that humans are failable, and that's why we watch the games.
Yeah. As my old coach would say, unlucky, and we moved on. Kevin Baxter, writes for the LA Times. He's been writing about the World Cup. He's in France, currently on a bus. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Remember, once a thorn, always a thorn.
Of course, always. and that game is on Friday, tomorrow, on the broadcast Fox. Thanks again, Kevin.
Thank you for the call.
The Heather McCoy Show.
And welcome back to The Heather McCoy Show. Join me on the line is Dawn Paley. Her new book is Drug War Capitalism. It's an eye-opening look at the war on drugs, and it adds context to a very murky and dark situation in U.S. foreign policy. Welcome to the show, Dawn.
Thanks, Heather.
So before we start with how the drug war is used to further neoliberal policies to open up new markets for capitalism, I think we should start off with kind of a background to the war on drugs domestically, which has an interesting history that started at the end of the 1800s as local measures that reflected anti-immigrant views.
Yeah, I mean, I document a little bit in the book, in chapter two, kind of do a bit of an overview of the war on drugs was declared by Nixon, but sort of the precursors to that war. I mean, some of the nuggets that I dug up in the course of my research were that, for example, cocaine was basically first manufactured in Colombia and Peru by German and U.S. pharmaceutical companies, for example. And, you know, this is something that I think also carries through to today. So you see the involvement of these governments that later go on to persecute these substances in their creation and their promotion. In terms of the domestic drug war or precursor or prefiguration of the drug wars in the U.S., you had the persecution of primarily people of Mexican descent for using marijuana, and then also the persecution of Chinese folks in the United States on the pretext that they were using opium. So there's all kinds of interesting bits and pieces of history. I didn't really focus on the present-day war on drugs in the United States just because that obviously deserves its own treatment.
Yeah.
I do refer to Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, which I think is a really good resource for folks you know, who are interested in really excellent research and very social justice-oriented work around the impact of the drug war in the United States today.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder, domestically with the war on drugs, how it's created the U.S. as the largest prison population on Earth. I often wonder if there's a correlation between our deindustrialization of our economy that started in the 80s and the growth of our prison population as a way to store excess working-class population without jobs.
I mean, it seems feasible in many ways, but it's not something that I necessarily have the hard data or the research on. I do think that there's some work around methamphetamines. I think there's a book called Methland, which I read part of as I was researching the book, which sort of looks at the deindustrialization of parts of the American Midwest and the use of meth and the criminalization of populations using it as well.
Yeah. With the modern policy that we live with today, that occurred when President Nixon declared a war on drugs in 1969 mm-hmm. and passed a comprehensive drug and prevention and control act. How was the war on drugs a way to stifle political rebellion in the 70s and open the door wider for federal involvement in policing?
Well, what's interesting is that I found out that the United States wasn't the only country to use the pretext of narcotics and policing narcotics as a way to crack down on dissent. In her excellent book, The Political Economy of Narcotics, Julia Buxton writes about how that was actually something that was done sort of across the political spectrum. So it was done in the Soviet Union, it was done in Europe, it was done in the United States, this use of drugs, use of narcotics to criminalize basically post-1968 political dissent and dissent among youth. But the United States, obviously, as time went on, has proven to be a special case, you know, the highest prison population on the planet by far. And, you know, so many people, for example, at one point recently, more than 50% of people in federal prisons in the United States were there because of drug charges. So, you know, the book kind of looks briefly at those policies in the United States since the 1960s, and you saw things like, for example, in the 1980s, drugs were used, and policing narcotics was used as an excuse to change posse comitatus, which previously prevented the army from participating in domestic police operations in the United States. And what they argued was that because of the Colombian drug cartels and the nefarious narcotics dealers, that you know the army in the U.S. could actually participate in policing if it had to do with narcotics. So that's kind of one example of that kind of leakage or that kind of spillage, where you know the militarization of policing linked to again policing narcotics is happening in the U.S. And I argue that that kind of slippage is what we later go on to see in much more overt ways in South America.
The media narrative surrounding the foreign policy version of the war on drugs is that there's helpless state governments that are taking on cartels in Colombia and Mexico who traffic drugs, and then and it's basically government agents versus the cartels, and that's how the media framework in the U.S. sees our foreign involvement with the drug trade. How did you discover the narrative that you lay out throughout your book?
Well, I describe what you just kind of mentioned as a cartel wars narrative. So you have the state created and sponsored narrative and promoted by the mainstream media, like you said, that the drug war is really about these bad guys fighting among themselves and the state trying to intervene. And I started to think differently about this after having been multiple times to Ciudad Juarez across the border from El Paso, Texas, and just meeting over and over with people there, with people who've survived the violence, with journalists, with researchers, who just kept insisting that what was happening in Ciudad Juarez, although the media every day was bombarding people with the idea that the violence there, you know, what it became known as the murder capital of the world or the most violent city on the planet between 2008 and 2010. So the media was telling people every day that the reason for all that violence, the spike in violence, was a split and a war basically with the Sinaloa cartel. And that there was maybe Zetas getting in there and that there was other cartels involved. But what people were telling me through these interviews who had lived in the city most of them for the majority of their lives was that in fact the violence really started to get out of hand in Juarez when the city was militarized in 2008, when 5,000 federal police officers and 5,000 soldiers were sent into the city supposedly to fight the drug cartels, that folks were able to trace basically directly the arrival of a huge amount of troops to the city and the explosion of violence. And actually when those police and soldiers left Juarez, at the same time, essentially within months, the murder rate dropped not exactly to what it was before, but significantly. And so that was sort of a concrete experience, and having gone back to the city numerous times and continuing to interview people and just realizing, okay, this isn't one or two people that are describing this to me. This is something that, you know, you can strike up a conversation with someone and they'll say, you know, we're being attacked by police, or the problem is that the soldiers are, you know, involved in the violence or involved in the disappearance of people and so on. So that case of Juarez was the first one where I was really able to start to see through that mainstream discourse.
Yeah, you describe it very well. You say basically that it's a war against the people in those countries, and it's not. You make a very clear distinction that the people that you're talking about, the civilians, are not, you know, casualties. I forget the term that it's used right now, but they're not just like
collateral damage.
They're not collateral damage. They're the targets.
Exactly, and that's actually something that I first started to learn about while I was working in Colombia quite a few years ago with the Nasa people in the south of Colombia. And you know, there's the guerrilla fighting the paramilitary groups in the state. So they, you know, they refer to all these different groups as being armed actors. And again, what the media is telling us about that conflict, whether you're within Colombia or if you're reading something, you know, an international reporter, is that all of these armed actors are fighting each other, and that the civilians, the regular people who are being killed are again, like this kind of collateral damage. And what the NASA people insist on over and over again is that they are not collateral damage, that the attacks on them and the violence is against them, and it has to do with pushing them off their territory. And so, you know, part of the inspiration for this book was that I had worked in Colombia in the early, mid-2000s, and then having gone later to Mexico and watched the Merida Initiative, which is modeled on Plan Colombia, being introduced there, and see some of those same discourses coming out in the mainstream narrative about, you know, about the war being between bad guys and the state, when actually what you're seeing when you start visiting these places is that it's regular folks, especially people who are marginalized in society, people who work in the informal sector, for example, which is a large segment of the population, upwards of 50% in parts of Central America, migrants and so on, who are actually the people who tend to be the targets of this violence. And they're often presented in the media as having been involved in something. You know, they were, you know, for example, in Mexico they talk about narcofosas, which means narco grave. And so for a long time when they would find mass graves in Mexico over the past few years, this is a fairly recent phenomenon, it would automatically be assumed that all of the people in those graves were responsible for their own deaths, basically. Because they must have been doing something bad to end up there. That's a narrative that's promoted by the state, it's promoted by the police, and it's repeated by the media. And it's really only when you start going into communities and talking to folks and also paying attention to the work that activist groups are doing and otherwise to make visible what's actually going on that you start to realize, wait a second, of course everyone that's being murdered aren't involved in the drug trade. I mean, even if they are, that doesn't justify their murder. But they're just simply not. In fact, many of these people are just involved in, like I said, the informal economy. They're communal landowners. They're indigenous people, queer people, folks who are marginalized, often and discriminated against in these countries. These are the people who are often being murdered in the context of this war.
Talk about how the armed actors, the cartels, and the state police are essentially in parallel with each other, and sometimes they work for the state, sometimes they work for a corporation like Chiquita Banana.
Right. I mean, this is really one of the most difficult pieces, I think, in the book, in that it's very difficult to prove. Like, there's a few cases where we get a little bit of light shone on the collaboration between state security forces and paramilitary groups. For example, in Colombia, you had the United Self-Defense Groups, the AUC, which was patrolling large sections of the country, and every once in a while it would surface that paramilitary group, which is primarily financed through drugs, that they would do joint patrols with Colombian military, for example, or they would be sharing resources with the Colombian military. Through court cases, we were later able to get information about the collaboration between huge corporations like Chiquita Bananas, like Drummond, the mining company, like BP, the oil company, these really the sort of cream of the crop, largest transnational corporations on the planet, collaborating with these same paramilitary groups in order to, for example, control union organizing, or ensure that you know, people who are protesting or who refuse to leave their lands for the construction of an oil pipeline, for example, would be eliminated, would be removed from the territory by groups that appear not to have anything to do with the state or the Colombian state or the corporation itself. And interestingly, there was in 2008, there was the beginning of kind of an opening of a de-paramilitarization process, which never actually came to fruition. But part of what happened during that process was a couple of the big paramilitary leaders started to speak out, and they started to name the Congress people and the senators that they had financed their campaigns, that they had supported their campaigns, that they had supported their political activities as paramilitaries. And as soon as those folks started talking, they really didn't last very long. They were actually extradited to the United States.
Oh, wow.
And those extraditions were for charges of drug trafficking, which is, of course, much less than what the kinds of charges they would have faced in Colombia, which probably would have been closer to something like crimes against humanity, for massacres, killings, disappearances, etc. And what those extraditions did was it silenced those paramilitaries, those leaders who paramilitary leaders who began to speak out about all the links between the state and the paramilitary groups. So, you know, you see also a very active hand of the United States in controlling, that message and the possibility that the information of the depth of the collaboration between these different groups gets out. Just to speak to Mexico for a moment, so in the book I sort of trace the drug war, the modern drug war, or the sort of type of drug war that's taking place in the Southern Hemisphere, as starting with Colombia with Plan Colombia in 2000, and then coming up to Mexico through the Merida Initiative, and these are both U.S.-backed, primarily military initiatives based around controlling this rhetoric of controlling the amount of drugs arriving to the United States. And then there's the Central America region in Central America. So in the book, I sort of look at what happened in Colombia and then what starts to happen in Mexico, or increasingly is happening in Mexico from 2008, and that's sort of the focus of the book. And I also argue in the book that we can start, or that we may start, to consider these drug cartels in Mexico as being something more similar, in fact, to paramilitary groups. It's not a discourse that we're particularly used to hearing with regards to Mexico. There's very, a focus almost exclusively on the cartels, the Sinaloa cartel and the Gulf cartel and the Zetas and so on. But, in fact, recent events like the disappearance of the 43 students in Guerrero in September, I think, help us to understand how those drug cartels are actually more like paramilitary groups than they are like drug cartels. The main difference there being that a paramilitary group does work with state forces directly.
Yeah.
So we know, for example, right, with the kidnapping of those students, that the police officers who arrested them passed them off to members of what the state calls Guerreros Unidos, or organized crime, but which I argue are actually more like a paramilitary group because they're working directly with those state forces. So that's kind of another example, another manifestation of how those connections exist between official state forces and these drug cartels or paramilitary groups.
One of the questions I have is, like, how did the drug war evolve? Because, like, in 82, Reagan started the crop eradication. And was it always like a neoliberal plan to basically, it's basically a multinational corporate manifest destiny where it's an acquisition of land and territory and resources. Was it always that way? Or how did we get from the 70s to Plan Colombia? When was it kind of activated within a, I don't know, it's like a cousin policy of the IMF and World Bank. Was it always that way? Or did Plan Colombia like derive a new threshold of like neoliberalism policies within the drug war?
Yeah, that would basically be, I think the argument that I make in the book is that previous to Plan Colombia, there was all these piecemeal efforts. There was crop eradication. There was, infiltration of policing. The DEA was active in Mexico and Colombia and elsewhere. I write in the book about how the U.S. actually attempted to apply sanctions to Colombia at one point in the 1990s. But the main victims of the sanctions, so to say, or those who were hurt by those sanctions, turned out to be U.S. oil companies. So they tried all these different methods, but a little bit piecemeal. And it was really with Plan Colombia where you see the sort of modern, like, totalitizing drug war, where you say, okay, we're going to militarize the police, we're going to retrain all these police officers, we're going to activate the army, we're going to fund all this new equipment for the police and the army. We're also going to fund the total overhaul of the legal system, change the legal system in Colombia from a written accusatorial system with its own legal tradition into a copy, what one of my sources in the book called a cheap copy, of the U.S. legal system. and introduce a bunch of new regulations. New regulations to improve the business climate, to encourage investment, et cetera. So this sort of big package, which includes things not exactly like structural adjustment, certainly not framed like structural adjustment, but which, you know, are all about making the business climate better, happening side by side with really intense militarization, and that militarization leading to an intensification of the paramilitarization. Very full project, very sort of total project for Colombia. That, I argue, is essentially that's a new model, and I think that's when we can start to really point to a neoliberal style drug war, a foreign drug war, for, you know, backed primarily by the United States, but of course other countries are also active, European countries, Israel, Canada, et cetera.
Yeah, you mentioned an improved business climate. That was one of the funnier things in the book, where it was just like, yeah, Plan Colombia didn't stop any cocaine from entering the U.S., but it was successful because it improved the business climate in Colombia, and they basically took a lot of indigenous lands and turned it into mining operations.
Yeah, it was basically just the moment, Heather, when I realized, like, okay, I can do this book. Like, I had this sort of intuition about what was going on, but when I found that report, a report by the Government Accountability Office in the United States, and it included statements from people from the State Department and USAID saying that very same thing, basically saying, well, you know, it's been a failure in terms of the actual thing that it was supposed to do. You know, it's been a failure in terms of reducing the amount of cocaine reaching the United States, but it's been a success in terms of promoting the overall goals of U.S. foreign policy. And it's been a success in terms of creating a better business climate. When I realized that, you know, U.S. administration officials themselves were admitting that, I thought, okay, there's something here.
Yeah, there's...
Right? It's not the repetition of a failed policy in Mexico. It's using that same discourse of the drug war, which of course is going to fail. But the actual goals of the policy are far different than what we're presented with. And that's why I argue in the book that we need new metrics to start to understand what success and failure means in this context.
Yeah, and some of the things they export are they have this education system which is high on standardized testing, because they basically want to import. They're using the violence and stuff, so it's really hard to organize against things like education reform, quote unquote, where you basically have standardized testing so you can work in the maquiladoras on the border.
Exactly, and I mean, it can bring it right back again to Ayotzinapa. I mean, those students in the normal school in Ayotzinapa, Guerrero, have for the last many years, they've been known as very combative, but particularly in the last few years, been fighting very hard. They've been at the forefront of the fight in Mexico against education reforms, demonstrating all the time, you know, being very active in their communities and in the state and nationally in terms of fighting those education reforms that are doing things like, you know, standardized testing, trying to get rid of or make access more difficult, or that would result in, you know, access to education becoming more difficult for poor and working people in Mexico, et cetera. Those students, you know, that's what they were known for, essentially, was this major struggle against these neoliberal reforms to education. And so, you know, it's no coincidence that these militant, combative students who are organized were targeted for this horrific violence that, you know, still hasn't been resolved in any way.
Yeah.
Although the Mexican government has closed the case, and they say that all the people responsible for disappearing those students are now in jail, the Mexican people just don't believe it. It simply isn't true.
Yeah, it reminds me of the story that you told about the girl that was killed in the desert, and then when the mom demanded to find where her body was left, she was said, the first state official said yes, and then they said no, and then the whole team of people took her on this really long route to get there, and then she found a trail up to a road, and oh, there was a military group. So everyone involved with that party knew that there was something not quite right there.
Exactly, and these are just the little stories that you hear from people. I mean, by little, I don't mean unimportant. I just mean the sort of micro individual stories that people will tell you about their own struggles, about their own, losing a relative or a friend or a family member in this country presents people with this maze of searching, you know, for the disappeared or attempting to access justice in some way. And this story that I tell at the beginning of the chapter that's focused on the army and police involvement in the violence here in Mexico really, I thought, demonstrated that. But it's just one of, I think, what so many other stories, you know, and I continue to collect testimonies and learn from people about the ways in which state officials in this country are regularly involved in covering up the tracks of criminals, be those criminals affiliated with the state or not affiliated with the state. But it's just this, you know, thing that you hear over and over again about the refusal of state officials to actually assist families, and their constant recurrence to actually covering up the crimes of these criminal groups. It's totally heartbreaking. It's horrific.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, the guest I have on the air right now joining us from Mexico is Dawn Pele. Her new book is Drug War Capitalism. It's out right now on AK Press. And so I don't know Spanish very well at all, basically. So if I mispronounce this, bear with it. So Ojos, the communal farmers, how do they deal with the privatization schemes of their land involving banks?
Okay, so they're called ejidos.
Ejidos, okay.
And the ejidos are communal landowners that are recognized by the Mexican government. And, you know, many of the ejidos date back 50, 70 years. And in fact, most recent statistics continue to tell us that upwards of 50% of the national territory in Mexico is actually in the hands of communal landowners. So they're very important feature in Mexican agriculture, Mexican politics, and Mexican social organizations, these ejidos, primarily in rural areas. And, you know, in 1994, when NAFTA was signed, there had been a constitutional change which allowed the communal land to be sold privately. But what, and then that's often talked about as a, this is, NAFTA was so bad, look at what NAFTA did. It privatized, it allowed all the privatization of all this communal land. But when you actually look at it, what you learn, and you study carefully, is that many, many people in these ejidos, they simply refuse. They refuse to let the government come and map their lands. They refuse to let them parcel it, and they refuse to let them privatize it. So what I kind of argue in the book is basically that the, you know, some of the violence from the drug war can be understood as basically efforts to undo these communal landowner structures. They couldn't do it legally. They couldn't do it through paperwork. They couldn't do it through bureaucracy. People simply do not want to leave their land, the land that they own together and that they farm together and so on. And that the use of intimidation by federal police officers, the use of violence from the state or from non-state groups has actually become the resource that the state is using in order to try to open up those lands, because many, right now, much of ejido land is of great interest, particularly to mining companies. So where you had lands before that, for example, didn't have access to irrigation, and I'm not talking about all ejido lands, but where the lands weren't considered particularly valuable before, now they take on another light because there's minerals there. And so that, you know, extra sort of interest of transnational mining corporations, for example, wanting to operate on ejido lands is something that has sparked conflict across the country over the past, I would say, decade, over and over again. But what you see is with those conflicts now taking place in the sort of framework of a very militarized drug war, you tend to see more acts of violence against communal landowners and activists in those communities who are trying to protect their lands.
Talk about the violence against activists and how it basically kills any movement that tries to take off.
Well, I mean, that's a very interesting and very tough question. I found that, you know, during the writing of the book, I wanted to focus not just on activists, right? Like we talked about before, for example, how people being targeted in this war are, you know, informal laborers and migrants and so on. But
yeah.
Activists as well, right? Not exclusively activists, but certainly not to say that activists are not being targeted. I include in the book one section of in the north of Chihuahua State, where members of an ejido were fighting a Canadian mining company, and two of the main activists were murdered. They were shot point blank in their vehicle. And what was interesting to me about this case in particular, and what kind of differentiated it, was that the mining company, the Canadian mining company, later came out and said, well, you know, I don't know why people are making such a big deal out of this. There's like 100,000 people who've been murdered in Mexico in the past 6 years, and these are just two more.
Yeah.
That's just kind of like one example, right, of where you have this sort of overall intensification of violence socially. What was surprising was that the company would just say it in those words, right, would say, well, you know, what's the big deal? People get killed here all the time. Just that normalization of violence allows, you know, for many different kinds of people to be murdered and for it to just be made to seem like it's just random and it's normal here. And certainly activists have been targeted repeatedly. You know, Ayotzinapa, I think, is one of the main key examples. We need to understand that these students were very organized and very militant, and that's why they were targeted. That's why, you know, they were disappeared. And so you see this in throughout the country in all different regions. Shortly after what took place in Ayotzinapa, another activist in Guerrero was murdered. It's a quite a constant thing. And the drug war and the overall escalation of violence against the population makes it far easier for the state and for corporations to just say, well, they're just two more. It's just one more death, you know, in a very violent place, and it wasn't necessarily political, which is, of course, a very, very, very dangerous and scary discourse for everyone who lives in Mexico. And, you know, I mentioned briefly, but I also have a short chapter about Honduras and Guatemala in the book, and the idea was to not say this is a Mexico problem, what's happening with the drug war and the drug war violence. Rather say this is what happens when you apply this kind of U.S.-backed policy in these countries, and you actually see that there's quite similar kinds of violence and kinds of promotion of foreign direct investment and so on happening in all of these different places.
Yeah, foreign direct investment skyrocketed after Plan Colombia. So one of the things that was kind of interesting was I was in the middle of reading your book. I think I was on the Colombia chapter at the time, and I was on Facebook, and this friend linked to a story from Rutgers about a 42-year-old woman running for mayor. And her name was Ada Neva, and she was actually kidnapped and decapitated. And then before I clicked on it, I'm like, $100, she's a leftist. And then I clicked on it, and sure enough, she was. It's just amazing how your thesis holds up in the real world.
It's something that I'm not happy about, you know, in some ways. Like, I wish it would be disproven and things would be overturned and it wouldn't continue on this way. But I think that what drug war capitalism does offer is a framework that's useful right now for understanding how the drug war is not something that's not political. It's not something that's just about dollar bills and cocaine. It is actually, you know, a kind of a counter-revolutionary war. It's a reactionary war. It's a war against the people. I wish the thesis wouldn't hold up. I wish the violence would stop.
Yeah, my guest has been Dawn Paley. Her new book is Drug War Capitalism from AK Press. It's out now. Thanks for being on the show this morning, and we'll hopefully have you on soon again.
Thank you so much, Heather. It was a pleasure talking to you this morning, and I'd love to come back sometime.
Okay, yeah, of course. This is the Heather McCoy Show.
If they don't stop the clickety-clatter, I'll jump in the undertow penguin pattern and drown in my wedding gown.
I've been told the bronze river stream.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 10:59. Coming up next on Between the Covers, author Miriam Toe is interviewed about her latest read, Women Talking, a novel that asks, how do women who have lived their entire lives in a society that severely limits their agency act when suddenly needing to exercise it? And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures. Guest host Ken Jones sits down with graphic novelist Michael Kupperman. Don't forget that you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to KBOO.fm and or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Tune in to KBOO on July 4th through the 7th for our live broadcast from the 32nd Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. We'll start the broadcast from the Waterfront Blues Festival on Thursday, July 4th at noon, and broadcast the fest every day from noon through 10 p.m. Again, that's the Waterfront Blues Festival, the largest celebration of blues, soul, funk, and rhythm and blues west of the Mississippi, July 4th through the 7th from noon to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the writer Miriam Taves. Taves has a BA in Film Studies from the University of Manitoba and a journalism degree from the University of King's College in Halifax. She's both produced radio documentaries and written for magazines and garnered the 1999 National Magazine Award Gold Medal for Humor. Taves also played the leading role in Carlos Regatta's film Silent Light, a film that took place in a Mennonite colony in northern Mexico. Silent Light was the winner of the jury prize at the 2007 Cannes Film Festival, was on many film critics' lists of the best films of the year, and is a film for which Taves was nominated for Best Actress at the Mexican Academy of Cinematographic Arts and Sciences.